My father was a Ghanaian patriot. When he died, my sisters and I found a note he had drafted and never quite finished, last words of love and wisdom for his children. After a summary reminder of our double ancestry in Ghana and in England, he wrote, "Remember that you are citizens of the world."
Welcome to Cambridge Forum. My name is Gail Leftwich, and I am director of Cambridge Forum. Cambridge Forum is now in its 30th year of providing live public forums for the discussion of vital policy issues, with the goal of offering citizens useful information about the challenges facing contemporary society. The subject for discussion for this first of several programs on this topic is Beloved Community, Visions for a World Beyond Racism. Our speaker, scholar and philosopher Kwame Anthony Appiah, is professor of Afro-American Studies at Harvard and author of numerous books and articles, including In My Father's House, Africa in the Philosophy of Culture, and most recently, a book with Amy Gutman of Princeton University, Color Conscious, The Political Morality of Race.
Thank you very much indeed, and I'm honored and pleased to be here involved in the Beloved Community series, and I hope that what I have to say will seem, at least by the end, to be importantly relevant to the theme of the Beloved Community. My father was a Ghanaian patriot. He once published a column in the Pioneer, our local newspaper in Kumasi, under the headline, "Is Ghana Worth Dying For?" And I know that his heart's answer was yes. But he also loved Asante, the region of Ghana where he and I both grew up, a kingdom absorbed within a British colony and then a region of a new multi-ethnic republic, a once kingdom that he and his father both loved and served. And like so many African nationalists of his class and generation, he always loved an enchanting abstraction they called Africa. When he died, my sisters and I found a note he had drafted and never quite finished, last words of love and wisdom for his children. After a summary reminder of our double ancestry in Ghana and in England, he wrote, "Remember that you are citizens of the world." And he went on to tell us that this meant that wherever we chose to live, and as citizens of the world, we could surely choose to live anywhere that would have us, we should make sure we left the place better than we found it. Deep inside of me, he went on, is a great love for mankind and an abiding desire to see mankind under God fulfill its highest destiny. The favorite slander of the narrow nationalist against us cosmopolitans is that we are rootless. What my father believed in, however, was a rooted cosmopolitanism, or if you like, a cosmopolitan patriotism. Like Gertrude Stein, he thought that there was no point in roots if you couldn't take them with you. "America is my country and Paris is my hometown," Stein said. My father would have understood her. In a world of cosmopolitan patriots, people accept the citizens' responsibility to nurture the culture and the politics of their homes. Many would no doubt spend their lives in the very places that shaped them, and that is one of the reasons local cultural practices will always be sustained and transmitted. But many would move, and that would mean that cultural practices would travel also, as they have always traveled. And the result would be a world in which each local form of human life was the result of long-term and persistent processes of cultural hybridization. A world, in that respect, much like the world we live in now. But I'm also a liberal, and the liberal cosmopolitanism of the sort that I'm defending can put its point like this. We value the variety of human forms of social and cultural life. We don't want everybody to become part of a homogeneous global culture. And we know that this means that there will be local differences, both within and between states, in moral climate as well. So long as these differences meet certain general ethical constraints, so long in particular as political institutions respect the basic human rights, we are happy to let them be. Part of what the equal dignity of all persons means for the liberal, and that is, I think, the central liberal idea, is that we respect people's autonomous decisions for themselves, even when they are decisions we judge mistaken or simply choices we would not ourselves have made. This is a liberal principle that fits well with the cosmopolitan feeling that human cultural difference is actively desirable. My father's example demonstrates for me more clearly than any abstract argument the possibilities that the enemies of cosmopolitanism deny. We cosmopolitans can be patriots, loving our homelands, not only the states where we were born, but the states where we grew up or the states where we have chosen to live. Our loyalty to humankind, so vast, so abstract a unity, doesn't deprive us of the capacity to care for lives that are nearer by. So the fundamental thought of the cosmopolitanism I defend is that the freedom to create oneself, the freedom that liberalism celebrates, requires a range of socially transmitted options from which to invent what we call our identities. Our families and schools, our churches and temples, our professional associations and clubs provide two essential elements in the toolkit of self-invention. First, they provide the ready-made identities: son, husband, doctor, Methodist, mensch, whose shapes are constituted by norms and expectations, stereotypes and demands, rights and obligations. And second, they give us a language in which to think about these identities, and a language with which we may shape new ones. Now, among the resources thus made available in our contemporary form of social life for the construction of a personal identity is something called a national identity, and that's the form of identity that is central to the possibility of a modern patriotism. The president spoke yesternight, you don't say that here, but in Ghana we say yesternight, of the importance of national community. It strikes me that these are times in which we need to think deeply about national identity, and I want to begin by asking what, for a cosmopolitan patriot, the role of a nation, national culture might be. Now, the citizens of one of the large imagined communities of modernity we call nations are not likely to be centered on a common culture. There is no single shared body of ideas and practices in India that sits at the hearts of the lives of most Hindus and most Muslims, that engages all Sikhs and excites every Kashmiri, that animates every untouchable in Delhi and organizes the ambitions of every Brahmin in Bombay. And I'm inclined to say that there is not now, never has been, a centering common culture in these United States either. The reason is simple enough. The United States has always been multilingual. I mean, many of these things are suppressed in our official history, so let me remind us of them, has always been multilingual and has always had minorities who didn't speak or understand English. It's always had a plurality of religious traditions, beginning, of course, with Native American, American Indian religions, and Iberian Catholics and Jews, and British and Dutch Puritans and Protestants of various sorts, and including now many varieties of Christianity, Judaism, Islam, Buddhism, Jainism, Taoism, Baha'i, and so on. And many of these religious traditions have been quite unknown to each other. More than this, Americans have also always differed significantly, even among those who do speak English, from north to south and east to west, and from country to city, in customs of greeting, notions of civility, and a whole host of other ways that I first learned about when I moved from Ithaca, New York, to Durham, North Carolina. My one piece of anthropological wisdom about that is that in the city of New York, if people are friendly towards you, they intend to be helpful. In North Carolina, people can be very friendly with no such good intentions. The notion that what has held the United States together historically over its great geographical range is a citizenry centered on a common culture of this, in this sense, is, to put it politely, not sociologically plausible. Now, the observation that Americans are not centered on a national culture doesn't answer the question whether there is an American national culture. Comments about American culture taken as a whole are routine, and it would be taking on a fairly substantial consensus to deny them all. American culture is, for example, held to be individualist, litigious, and racially obsessed. I think each of these claims is actually true, because what I mean when I say that Americans are not centered on a common culture is not what is denied by someone who says that there is a common culture, an American culture in this sense. Such a person is describing large-scale tendencies within American life that are not invariably participated in and are certainly not equal important to all Americans. And I don't mean to deny that there are some of these. But for such a tendency to be part of what I'm calling the common culture, they'd have to derive from beliefs and values and practices almost universally shared and known to be so. And for it to center the lives of Americans, this common culture would have to be at the core of the individual lives of most Americans. And I want to deny that there is any common culture that centers most Americans in that way. At the same time, it's always been true that there's a dominant culture in the United States. It is Protestant, it speaks English, and it identified for a long time with the high cultural traditions of Europe and more particularly of England. This dominant culture included much of the common culture that centered most members of the dominant classes, the government and business and cultural elites. But it was familiar to many others who were subordinate to them. And it was, of course, not merely an effect, but also an instrument of domination. Now, the United States of America, then, has always been a society in which people have been centered on a variety of common cultures. Recognizing that what we in America are not centered on a national common culture is then perfectly consistent with recognizing that American citizens do have a common culture. What's interesting and important about it is that for many Americans, this American core, and in particular the attachment to the constitutional order and the rights it conveys, is not at the center of their lives. They support these institutions. They are in favor of them. Many people have come here precisely because of them. But still, these values are in some sense instrumental in their lives. What they desire centrally, what shapes and centers their lives, is what the American freedoms make possible. Your experience in a temple or mosque or church, my life with my family and the cultural riches of New York City or Boston that surround us, her search for philosophical understanding, their existence in a lesbian commune. They need America. They will defend it, but it is not at the heart of their dreams. Well, we've come to a crux, for if this is the situation, shouldn't the cosmopolitan, who's an American patriot, resent these fellow citizens for whom the country is a mere instrument, a means, as it were, rather than an end? And my answer is, of course, no. For the French and American revolutions invented a form of patriotism that allows us to love our country as the embodiment of principles, precisely as a means to the realization of certain moral ideas. It's true that the patriot values always more than what the state makes possible for her or hers, but if among the ideals we honor in America is that it aims to enable a certain kind of human freedom, then we cannot in consistency enforce attachment either to the state or to the principles. In valuing the autonomous choices of free people, we value what they have chosen in part because they have chosen it. And so a forced attachment to a fine principle, while it doesn't diminish the principle, makes the attachment unworthy. Well, if force isn't the answer, there is, of course, another possibility. Why did I speak of force? Why don't we argue out democratically a common culture on which to center our national life? Well, my answer is because we don't have to. The question presupposes that what we really need is shared core values, a centering common culture, the project of, say, Bill Bennett. I think this is a mistake. What I think we really need is not citizens centered on a common culture, but citizens committed to common institutions, to the conditions necessary for a common life. And what I want to insist on is that that is not the same thing. To live together in a nation, what's required is that we all share a commitment to the organization of the state, to these institutions that provide the overarching order of our common life. But that doesn't require that we have the same commitment to these institutions or that they mean the same for each of us. We live already with examples of this situation so familiar that we may have forgotten them, so let me remind you. The First Amendment does many wonderful jobs, and one of them is to separate, as we say, church and state. Some of us are committed to this because we are religious. We see it as the institutionalization of a Protestant insistence on freedom of conscience. That's one reason for favoring the separation of church and state. Some of us are committed to it because we are Catholics, or Jews, or Muslims, who don't want to be pressed into conformity by a Protestant majority. Some of us are atheists who would like to be left alone. We can live together with this arrangement because we're all committed to it, even though we're committed to it for different reasons, and even though those different reasons mean it has a different meaning in our different lives. A shared political life in a great modern nation isn't like the life of a tribal fantasy. It can encompass this great diversity of meanings. When we teach children democratic habits, what we're creating is a shared commitment to certain forms of social behavior. And we can call this a political culture if we like, but the meanings, we need a shared political culture, but the meanings citizens give to their lives and to the political within their lives will be shaped not only through the public school by the state, but also by family and church, reading and television, and in our professional and recreational associations. If American political culture is what Americans have in common, it is pretty thin gruel. And, so I'm arguing, none the worse for that. Well, this sanguine conclusion will cause many patriots to object. In a world of changing challenges, shared institutions, shared laws, for example, need interpreting to fit new cases, new situations. And in thinking about those new cases, doesn't appeal have to be made to shared values, to substantial principles, even, in the end, to deep metaphysical convictions? If we're to decide, say, whether to permit abortions, this argument suggests, we must decide first whether our shared commitment to the preservation of innocent human life, a commitment some derive from the thought that we are all children of a loving God, applies to a fetus in its first 3 months. For many, though certainly not for all, Americans would oppose abortion if it was uncontroversially clear that it was the killing of an innocent human being. Don't our difficulties in discussing this question flow in part from precisely the lack of shared values that I'm arguing we must accept, that we must accept the lack? Well, it's here that the political values of the American Republic, this political culture I was talking about, have to come to have some weight of their own. Our democratic traditions require us to engage respectfully with our fellow citizens when they disagree with us. In this sense, a political culture, the shared commitment of the political institutions of the Republic, the content of our common citizenship, is more than an agreement just to abide by the Constitution and the laws, by the judgments of the courts, by the decisions of democratically elected lawmakers. It also involves a shared and evolving sense of the customary practice of political engagement in a public sphere. American citizenship, in other words, does require us to accept a political culture, and as the case of African Americans shows, it's important that that culture has built into it the possibility of change. Otherwise, African Americans could never have come to accept its political culture in the period of slavery or Jim Crow. But if, as a result of the processes of democracy, laws are passed that are deeply repugnant to you, as is perfectly possible in a society not centered on a strong common culture, you may well reach the point where you consider that you have been, in a certain sense, repudiated by the state. The price of having no common culture to center our society is that possibility. But the cosmopolitan patriot believes that the creation of a common culture rich enough to exclude this possibility would exact a higher price. This is something that many in the modern world, Catholic bishops in Ireland, Buddhist politicians in Sri Lanka, Ayatollahs in Iran, Communist Party members in China, do not believe. They want to live in societies where every political dispute can be resolved because everyone has been constrained to accept a common sense of the meaning of life, where everyone has a common cultural center. The political culture of the American state excludes this vision because it is, in the understanding of the term long forgotten in our public debates, a liberal political culture, one that values individuals and celebrates, with cosmopolitanism, the great variety of what individuals will choose when given freedom. A final reason for skepticism about the creation of a national common culture to center our lives is an historical skepticism. For us to center our lives on a national culture, the state would have to take up the cudgels in defining both the content of that culture and the means of its dissemination. This would create deep schisms in our national life. But history suggests an even deeper difficulty. Collective identities have a tendency, if I may coin a phrase, to go imperial, dominating not only people of other identities, but also the other identities whose shape is exactly what makes each of us what we individually and distinctively are. In policing this imperialism of identity, an imperialism as visible in national identity, in patriotism, as anywhere else, it is crucial to remember always that we are not simply Americans or Ghanaians, but that we are gay or straight or bisexual, Jewish, Christian, Muslim, Buddhist, Confucian, brothers and sisters, parents and children, liberals, conservatives and leftists, teachers and lawyers and automakers and gardeners, fans of the Padres and of the Bruins and of neither, amateurs of grunge rock and lovers of Wagner, movie buffs, MTV holics, mystery readers, surfers and singers, poets and pet lovers, students and teachers, and friends. The state makes much possible for all of us, and we owe it at least the consistent support to which it is entitled in virtue of these possibilities. It would be a grand irony if the price we paid for the freedom that the state creates was to allow it to subject us to new tyrannies. This is an especially powerful thought here in the United States, for so many have loved America in part exactly because it has enabled them to choose who they are and to decide, too, how Central America is to their chosen identity. Those of us who are not Americans by birth but by election and who love this country precisely for that freedom of self-invention cannot seek to compel others to an identity we ourselves celebrate precisely because we chose it freely. Martin Luther King Jr. once said, in explaining, as it happens, his opposition to the Vietnam War, that speaking out for the supposed enemies of his country was, and I quote, the privilege and burden of all of us who deem ourselves bound by allegiances and loyalties which are broader and deeper than nationalism, end quote. But if anyone were to argue that Martin Luther King cared nothing for America, was not a patriot, we should have to remind them that he called us Americans to live out the true meaning of our creed. Loyalty to humanity, I have been arguing, is part of what makes it possible to be loyal to country. Martin Luther King taught that we can find the beloved community everywhere. Thank you.
I know from reading your wonderful book, the one about your father's house, where you talk in the introduction about the very unique, I guess it's unique, international character of your own family experience, that may be something which has deeply colored your experience and made you amenable to a kind of a world vision that you've described. And I wonder if there's any relationship, direct relationship, between that kind of experience and the kind of vision you're talking about, and any limitation in cases where people simply have no way to see that vision. And I tried to imagine, for instance, in urban places like Boston, Cambridge, and so on, where people are really trapped in their little common cultures. And even though there's intermarriage, and even though at Cambridge Rindge in Latin you've got all these children from different ethnic backgrounds together and their parents speak different languages and all that, still very different in some profound way from the kind of international cosmopolitan experience you've had. And if that is a factor in somehow opening the sensibilities to this vision, then how do we address that problem?
Well, there's a less polite form of that question that I sometimes get, which is, aren't you just talking about a position that only makes sense with enormous privilege? Who pays for your airplane tickets?
Who pays for your airplane tickets?
The Social Science Research Council, I just have less money than I otherwise would because I have to keep in touch with my family. That's a real problem. I mean, that is, I don't deny that it's easier to see certain things from certain social positions, certain possibilities from certain social positions. That's the first thing I want to say. And so it is true that there is a kind of cosmopolitanism of the grand tour, if you like, which is the cosmopolitanism of people who are able to take a carriage and spend 6 months traveling around seeing the great sights of France and Italy and Germany because somebody somewhere on a plantation somewhere is making the income to make their life possible. So that's a real problem. But I want to say two things. First, some of the most open to other people and
curious about other people, people I know, are not privileged people. They're just people on my street in Kumasi who are just fascinated by visitors and by the other world, and who do not respond as, with a sense of threat to a sort of otherness, but merely with curiosity. Now, that's something that, in a respect in which cultures, in my experience, vary enormously. Mm-hmm. I think of France, for example, as a place that isn't particularly open in the same way as many Ghanaians are, for example. I think of England, which I know better, perhaps, as also, in some ways, rather incurious about the world. A lot of English people are just... You sort of tell them something about another place, and they'll say, oh, yes, really, that's very interesting, and then they'll sort of go back to what they were doing before. So there are cultural differences in this respect, but I don't think it's true that the only people who have ever, as it were, had a vision like this were enormously privileged. However, I want to say, the second thing I want to say is, yes, it is part of my privilege, which I am grateful for. I have these points of access which other people don't have. I think more people have them than perhaps some people who have responded to my book think. I think there are many forms of, as it were, diasporic family now in the world, many of them actually with branches in the United States for obvious reasons. And while it's... it makes a difference how much you can go back and forth, how many telephone bills you can afford to pay, whether you're on the internet. These are all questions that affect, you know, I communicate with my cousins on the internet, my nephews on the internet, and they live a long way away, but it doesn't cost, you know, anything other than the cost of the phone call to the local internet provider. And since they're under 18, their parents are pleased that it doesn't cost anything more than that either. So these questions about the material basis of the maintenance of the connections are very important questions. And again, I want to say that I see it the other way around for many people. People say this is something only visible from a position of privilege, and that's meant as a criticism. I think the criticism should be that the privilege is not available to more people. Yes. I think we should be trying to make a world in which more people have these forms of access. And finally, I want to say that one of the things that my sort of belief in freedom means is that I also want some people to be allowed to say, I like my village. And I'm not curious about the rest of the world. I like the stability of this place. I don't want to go anywhere. And I don't disrespect someone whose view is that view, though I worry about them coming to that conclusion without knowing anything about the world outside the village, because I worry about that as a limitation of their freedom, as a limitation of their autonomy. Choices made in the light of knowledge are autonomous choices. Choices made from the basis of ignorance are not.
Thank you, Professor Anthony Appiah. You have been listening to Cambridge Forum, a free public forum in Harvard Square, Cambridge, Massachusetts, co-sponsored by the First Parish Unitarian Universalist, the Lowell Institute, and the Friends of Cambridge Forum. For an audio cassette of this forum, beloved community, send $11 to Cambridge Forum, 3 Church Street, Cambridge, Massachusetts, 02138, or call 617-495-2727. Thank you for joining us.
Support for Cambridge Forum comes from the Massachusetts Foundation for the Humanities.